The following podcast is sponsored by Pegasus Resources. Enjoy. This is the Commodity Culture Podcast, where we interview prominent investors, fund managers, analysts, and company CEOs to give you an edge when it comes to investing in the commodity space. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Commodity Culture, where our goal is to make you a better investor in the commodities space. My name is Jesse Day. Before we dive in, standard disclaimer, nothing here is investment advice. Do your own due diligence. And today's guest is the CEO of Pegasus Resources, a diversified junior Canadian mineral exploration company with a focus on uranium, gold, and base metal properties in North America. We're going to be talking about the uranium market and more. It's Chris Timmons. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jesse. Good to be here.
Yes, good to have you here. I want to start with your current broad overview of the uranium sector. How do you currently see the supply-demand dynamics? And obviously, we're in a bull market. I think everybody's on the same page when it comes to that. The uranium price rising to $100, pulling back a bit, but still very strong. Is this bull market still in the early stages, in your view?
I think we've kind of moved past the early stages of this bull market, but I think what we're looking at here is probably one of the most sustained bull markets we probably see in uranium since, you know, it became a commodity back in the 1950s here. We've never seen a situation like this where the supply demand has just been so dislocated from each other. Supplies lagging big time, demand just keeps growing. Like every time we turn around, there's another new restart, there's another new reactor planned. We haven't even dealt with SMRs yet as far as modeling all this supply stuff comes. So I think we're in for a very sustained period here of higher prices for uranium. So we're not in the early stages of this bull market by any means, but I think what we're in is the center part of this, and I think it's going to be long and sustained. We've just never seen a tight market like this. We have lots of production planned to come on and some restarts for uranium mines and stuff. But any little hiccups, you know, over the next 3 or 4 years, we're really going to feel that in the market, I think, because demand just keeps outstripping supply. And supply is going to be chasing demand for probably into the 2030s, in my opinion, Jesse. So I think it's a great time to be a uranium investor. And I think we're in for some exciting times ahead.
And so how do SMRs factor into the supply-demand fundamentals in your view? Because I've heard everything from it's much too early to even speculate on SMRs because we do not have that technology at a level where it's being rolled out commercially yet, to the other side, which is it's going to be a complete game changer. What are you seeing in terms of small modular reactors and their potential impact on uranium demand?
Well, if any, there's money being thrown at SMRs, and we know anything, if you put enough money into something, you will make it work. Will a lot of money be wasted along the way? Maybe, but enough money and we can make anything work in this world. And what we're seeing is the people like Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Amazon, like we've got some heavyweight people that want to see SMRs come in, and they're very motivated to do this because these guys are all behind AI. And if you know anything about what's going on in the AI side of things right now, it is creating a lot of electricity demand going forward. And a lot of that was not modeled in. Like when we look back over 21, 22, 23, no one really planned for SMRs. Like it was not in the conversation. That's really only popped up in the last, what, year to 6 months and probably closer to 6 months. So I think the SMRs are going to happen. And it's just because pure brute force. Like we're going to make it happen. We've got over what 70 to 90 different designs out there. Certain companies like Westinghouse have a design that I think will come into the market very quickly just because it's built off of what they have already doing with their full size reactors. So really it's just a downscaling and some simplification of what they already do. So I think the SMR is going to be adopted. I think we will see them by 2030. And like I said, it's just back to if you put enough money at a problem, you will solve the problem and make it happen.
Yeah, and very interesting you mentioned AI because it requires so much more energy generation. Amazon Web Servers in Pennsylvania built a data center right beside a nuclear power plant to directly power it. So I think that could be a trend we could see accelerate moving forward as well. I'd like to shift to some great news out of South Korea, a country near and dear to my heart. I lived there for 8 years. They've announced they're planning to extend the lifespan of 10 nuclear reactors. The previous government, of course, had planned to shut those down. They were very anti-nuclear. This seems to be a sign of the times. We're seeing more and more, as you mentioned, restarts, extensions, more governments realizing how important nuclear is. What are your thoughts on this news coming out of Korea? Do you think we're going to see more of this from more countries around the globe?
Yeah, I think governments are waking up. We've been spoiled. We went through like 15 years of flat energy demand. Like electricity was just, the demand just was flatlined for 15 years. A lot of that was to do with efficiencies and all our appliances and all the new, you know, products we brought out that, you know, work off the grid. So those efficiencies, I think we've peaked on those as far as the current cycle we're in. So I think what we're seeing now is the realization that we just spent 15 years adding renewables to the grid and pulling baseload off of the grid. Like, dude, that's a big problem. We have like lots of energy, it sounds like, but when it really comes down to it and these renewables start swinging, we don't have enough. I live here in Alberta. We just went through rolling blackouts and it's not even hot out or cold out. Like, that's a real problem. 5 years ago, no one would have said we'd ever see a rolling blackout in this province, and they'd laugh at you if you even tried to bring it up. But now, boom, it just happened. We've got BC also, because I am in Canada, so I pay attention to that stuff a little more. BC used to be a net exporter of hydro power and all their other power drivers that they have. And now they're a net importer. So there's a lot of energy problems starting to come to the surface in the world. And I think South Korea and all these countries are starting to wake up to this reality. And the fact that we've loaded the grid with renewables and pulled off that baseload, that those are going to start to cause us some real issues over the next 10 years. And again, back to AI, no one planned for it. So that's going to actually just increase the speed with which this energy problem, you know, comes to the surface. So I think we're going to see a lot more reactors come online. What is it? 259, I think I was reading, of the existing 438 reactors in the world have already had an extension, Jesse. So I think we're going to see that continue. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see every 438 reactors, you know, at some point in their life here, get an extension and keep supplying this grid. And of course, everyone's going to need to add more just to keep up.
And following on that thread of growing acceptance for nuclear, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which has been very anti-nuclear previously, shut down that part of its efforts. I want to read a quote from the Financial Times. In November 2023, the Natural Resources Defense Council shut down its nuclear mission and laid off its top lawyer, along with its anti-nuclear litigation team, which had pursued decades of action against nuclear plants. This change mirrored similar actions by other anti-nuclear NGOs in recent months. The tables really are turning on those who oppose nuclear. They now appear to be insane, whereas if we go back several years, those of us campaigning for nuclear appeared to be a little strange. Do you think we can see more of these pivots, perhaps even in a staunchly anti-nuclear government like Germany or Austria?
I think these NGOs like NRDC and the Sierra Club, they're the real canary in the coal mine, in my opinion. What we're seeing is their funding dried up. It wasn't that they may have personally changed their point of views on nuclear or anything. It's just that their donors did. So it doesn't matter what the NGOs think and the nonprofits think. Their donors have changed their mind. I mean, that's a real shift across the political and social spectrum when you see this, you know, this donations to these NGOs dry up and disappear. To me, that says that we are seeing a broad change in the perspective of, you know, how important nuclear is and, you know, its safety profile and everything. I think it's we've reached the point where the world's waking up. Germany, I don't know what to say about Germany. I mean, they're paying some of the highest electricity prices in the world. Their manufacturing sector is sinking because of those high energy prices. I mean, they're in for a lot of hurt here if they don't change something. And, you know, they shut down their coal, their nuclear power plants, but they're extending their coal plants and building new natural gas fired power. Like, it seems kind of backwards, really. This sounds like something you'd want to do in the early 2000s, not something you'd want to do here in 2024, where everyone's waking up around the world to how important nuclear is to supply us with a clean and reliable baseload energy. So I think at some point, Germany's going to have no choice but to turn these reactors back on. They've got eight sitting there that are currently able to be brought back on. And I wouldn't be surprised if sometime between now and 2025, maybe 2026, they finally just admit that they have to do something and maybe turn some on or maybe turn them all on. But I don't know how long a country can survive when the rest of its neighbors are just adopting this energy profile. Like, nuclear is going to be blended in across the world. So I think Germany is eventually just going to have to admit that they were wrong and turn these reactors back on.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. For the sake of the German people and for the sake of humanity in general, we need nuclear in as many places as possible. I have to get your take. The big news, obviously, recently in the uranium sector is Kazatomprom indicating that they are going to miss production targets for 2024 and 2025 due to a sulfuric acid shortage for their ISR mining operations. This obviously seems very bullish. I've spoken to some people, Lobo Tigre being one of them, Rick Rule, who said this kind of changes the game in terms of that it seemed like some people joining the party now might be a little late. Now it looks like the supply-demand fundamentals are even more well set up because of this supply squeeze, because Kazatomprom might even have to buy on the spot market to fulfill contract obligations, which is obviously very bullish. What are your thoughts on that news coming out of Kazatomprom, the world's largest publicly traded uranium producer?
You know, it's pretty crazy that this company here is like, they were the leader for production forever, and now they're starting to run into basically walls. Like, the 2023, like you said, they didn't meet production. 2024, they're probably not going to meet production. 2025, they don't even want to give us an estimate on what their production is going to be. So we're probably safe to assume they're not going to get as high numbers as maybe they forecasted even a year or two ago. So I think there's a lot of problems going on over there, and I'm not sure if we're actually hearing about all of them or not. I mean, I've read some stuff here, whereas with this acid being deposited in, when they put the acid in down to these wells, the acid binds to the uranium. Now, as they deplete, they put in more acid. So are we seeing a situation here where Kazatomprom is actually like just injecting more acid into their existing fields to keep their production numbers up? And if that's the case, that's not a good sign for them and overall, especially where we're talking about having a shortage of acid. And of course, they're going to try and alleviate that shortage by building their own acid plant. But again, we don't know when that's going to actually happen. They predict 2026, maybe 2027, but nothing's getting built on target right now. Like, they're saying we're going to do this, then it's not happening. So I expect we're going to see a lot of more problems come out of Kazatomprom in the future. And as far as getting their new well fields up and stuff, you know, like, maybe there's something there too. Like, they're going to need a lot more acid. So their old workings are drawing in more acid. They want to bring in new production, which means they need to find more acid. And then I was seeing something today that they're looking to actually go outside of their home country. Like, they're talking about going into South America, Mongolia, South Africa, and in Africa in general, I should say. So what's up with that? Like, that was, I just saw that this morning, so I really haven't dug into it yet. But we're seeing them actually look at leaving their own country and go outside their region to produce uranium. Now, is that because they just believe in diversity? Or is that because they're actually having some problems at home that we're not sure, we're not aware of? So I think Kazatomprom is going to be on our radar for a long time to come. And I think any little hiccups over there, the market's going to feel it every time it happens.
Yes, and management has been a revolving door at that company as well. So I do agree. I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes that the public is not yet aware of. Grid Strategies, in their December 2023 report titled "The Era of Flat Power Demand is Over," had the following to say about energy demand in the U.S. Grid planners forecast peak demand growth of 38 gigawatts through 2028, requiring rapid planning and construction of new generation and transmission. They also added, "This is likely an underestimate. Several more recent updates are adding additional gigawatts to that forecast. Next year's forecast is likely to show an even higher nationwide growth rate." They also mentioned that the U.S. electric grid is not prepared for this type of demand growth. Obviously, nuclear is a great solution to rising energy demands. Do you expect further initiatives by the U.S. government to increase nuclear capacity? I believe the Inflation Reduction Act has some of that budget assigned to nuclear. They did have the Strategic Uranium Reserve, where they did a one-time purchase of some pounds of uranium from some producers in America. Do you think we're going to see more stronger government support moving forward to address this issue and have them support the nuclear industry and uranium mining industry as well?
Yeah, I think we will. The grid, like the USA grid, is like we were talking earlier here, is it's struggling already. And they're like everyone else, they're still pulling baseload off the market. So they're not fixing their problems either right now. There's lots of talk about, you know, bringing in more nuclear and growing SMRs and all that. But they're also having a problem with just keeping the grid as it stands right now stable. They're constantly replacing transformers on this grid, and they're struggling to keep up with those transformer replacements. So when we talk about growing the grid and we're already struggling to, you know, maintain the grid as it is, that means we are going to have some real problems coming, you know, over the next 5-10 years to address all this growth in power demand. So I think they're going to have to bring on some more reactors, because, well, here's one thing about these SMRs. You can put them where you need them. So instead of growing your grid out and like having to build these big high-powered transmission lines, plant some SMRs around the country. The DOE has a list of 200-something, 290-something coal-fired plants that are all able to be converted over to an SMR-type situation. So convert coal to SMRs. That'll get you more power out of an existing facility and, of course, way cleaner and way more stable in the long run. So I think we're going to see that the U.S. is going to have to start bringing in some more policies here to really bolster the grid in general, let alone grow it. So I think, again, that's another story where SMRs could come in and really help us out, because if you don't have to build these big, high, expensive transmission power lines, that makes the a lot easier to expand the grid and put the power where you need it. So if you're building a data center over here, you know, why not give that data center its own dedicated small modular reactor? That saves the local grid from having to deal with it, and it saves you from putting up all this big infrastructure. So I think there's a lot of strategies here that they can do going forward, but I think it's going to take money and it's going to take time and it's going to take nuclear energy.
Completely agree with you. Let's pivot to Pegasus Resources and how your company fits into all of this. Could you start by giving us an overview of the company for those who aren't yet familiar?
Sure. We're a uranium-focused exploration company. Our main focus right now is on our Energy Sands project in Utah, and we've got our other project up in the Athabasca Basin Pine Channel. So that's really our main focus right now, is working on them two properties, and we're in the business of finding uranium. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go out here, we're going to explore our properties, and we're just going to find some uranium.
Well, let's hone in on the Energy Sands project in Utah. Can you give us some more details on how it's advancing, what your plans are there, and maybe any color you could provide on Utah as a mining jurisdiction as well?
Sure. Well, let's just start with Utah in general. It's a great mining district. It's very historically been an important part of the uranium industry. Back in the 1950s, it was one of the largest producing areas there was. They did a lot of audit mining. So they, you know, drill an audit into the side of a cliff face or down into the ground and then just pull the uranium out of the ground. The grades in Utah are pretty good, actually, for USA standards. They're like anywhere from a 0.2 up to like a 0.4 across, you know, most of their deposits. So again, not Athabasca grade, where the average is around 1%, but it's really not that bad. And again, producing uranium and stuff in different regions obviously has different cost structures. And Utah is actually relatively cheap just because the uranium is shallow based deposits. So we can get at them through open pit mining and through underground mining. Utah is said to have some ISR potential. That's to be seen yet. I don't know anyone who's right now claiming they can do ISR in Utah. We're definitely going to monitor it as we go forward and drill our properties. And if that is something that we can do, we will jump on board and try to make that happen. As far as the property itself goes, Energy Sands, we staked that ourselves. So there's no options on that property. We own it 110%. 110%. And we're in a great area. We're a long trend of Western uranium vanadium. So we're in the right area. It's a past producing property here at Energy Sands. There is anywhere from 3 to 4 mines on it back in the 1950s that were mined for uranium and vanadium. So we know the property has mineable uranium on it. We did a ground program up here, in January. We did some samples collected off surface, and we collected some samples, obviously, from the historical audits that we found on the property. 41 samples we took off the property, and 11 of them came back over 1%, with one of a remarkable of 18.87%, which for Utah is quite mind-blowing. I've talked to a few old-timers in the area, past guys that have mined down there, and they're quite impressed that we found a sample that high. Again, you know, 1-2% was what we were expecting, honestly. So to see this number is quite encouraging. Again, these are selected samples. So we went around with a spectrometer and, you know, we were checking the ground to pick up samples. So we want to know with this program is where on the surface should we focus? And then that'll give us a really good indicator of where to start our drill program. So that's what we did. We used this program to really scout the surface area and put together a drill program. So now we've had these results back from the lab. Our next step for Energy Sands is to bring that data, put it into a drill permit, and apply for the permit. Utah, again, very mining friendly. We don't expect many hiccups, if any, for this drill permit. So 4 to 6 weeks after we submit it, we should receive it. So, you know, and we should see a permit here sometime around start of June, I'm guessing, in a perfect world. Maybe a little sooner. And as far as the property goes for infrastructure, our property is crisscrossed with roads, ATV trails, 4x4 trails. So when they did the ground program, we scouted out all our potential drill platforms that we want to do. So we already know where we want to put the platforms. So it's just a matter of getting in there, getting the permitting done, and getting some boots on the ground and drilling this property this summer. So that's really what we're doing with Energy Sands. And based on what we've seen from our neighbors, we should have some kind of a deposit on this property. Will it be economical? The only way to find out is to drill it. So that's really the plan for Energy Sands, is just to go down there, keep working it, drill the property, and see what kind of resource we can put together.
Great. Well, looking forward to seeing how that develops. Let's hear more about Pine Channel in the Athabasca Basin. Talk about the land package there and what you're doing with it.
Sure. Pine Channel was actually previously drilled by Denison Mines back in 1979 and 1980. So what we're doing is really, we're just building off a lot of the historical works that were done. So with Denison and UEX, a few other companies, there's a lot of historical geophysics done on the property. We've done a radon survey ourselves on the property, and we did have a permit here active. I believe that's expired here in April, but for drilling, we were going to drill the property this winter, but with the weather and everything, we decided we're going to hold off on that and just focus really on Energy Sands. So that's really what we did. We are going to work Pine Channel this summer. We're looking at doing a gravity survey, which would be fully funded. We've raised the money for that already. So it's the money sitting there. It's just a matter of getting the guys together and getting the work done. We will drill this property. Right now it's looking like 2025. So, you know, February, March, April 2025 will be next time we go up there to try and get a drill program done. Again, this is actually nice property. Part of the reason we didn't want to drill this year is because we can get in there without helicopter support. So that saves you like 30% of your budget if you can get that helicopter support out of there. The downside of it is that you need to have ice roads. So you need to have the availability of the frozen ground and the frozen ice to move your equipment around. And this winter was a little warm, as everyone noticed. So we were kind of like, maybe we'll just hold off on this whole thing because we could do a winter helicopter supported, but it's just so much more expensive. So I think we're just going to be patient and go in there this coming year and get that work done. And hopefully, I think we're in for a colder winter if you trust the long-term forecast.
Great. So your focus is most definitely uranium, but you also have a copper gold project in British Columbia. Obviously, two metals that have performed very well. Everybody's abuzz about gold at the moment, breaking, sustaining all-time highs. It continues to rip higher. Very fascinating thing to follow. Copper as well, doing exceptionally well. How much of a focus do you have on this property? Is this more ancillary to your focused uranium exploration? Could this become a core part of the business moving forward? And what are your plans for that property?
Well, this property actually predated the uranium property. So we've had this in our company before we actually moved into uranium. It is in BC. It's around Jasper there, to the southeast of Jasper. It's in the mountains, so it's obviously considered a remote location. But we love this property, and we've got investors that are just constantly bugging us to go up there and get more work done. We do have the property in good standing till 2025. So if we ignore the property this year, which is kind of what it's looking like, we're just going to let it sit this year. And then we're going to make plans to go in there in 2025 and get some work done. That's actually might work out great for us, just because, as you said, gold and copper just keep getting more expensive as time goes on. And like I said, we got people beating our door down. Like, they really love this property. Investors, geos, constantly got people that are just want us to do something with this. And we will. We'll create some value for shareholders, whether inside Pegasus or through a spin out or some other way. We will do something with this property. In the meantime, we are looking to put together a drilling permit for our Gold Mountain up there. So that's going to take a little time to get put together. And honestly, we have no clue when that permit will get approved. BC's kind of in a holding position right now while they figure out some stuff around how the mining royalty, or not mining royalties, how the mining claims and exploration work are going to move forward. So what we will do is we'll get this permit put together. We'll submit the permit. And if we get it in 2 months, okay, perfect. But if it takes us a year, that's fine too, because we already have, you know, plans to just not worry about it until 2025. So that's kind of what we're going to do with the property. Again, we love these properties up here in BC. We expect some great stuff coming off here in the future. But in the meantime, our main focus is going to be uranium, and that's really where we're going to put all our efforts.
Awesome. Well, it's been an incredible conversation, Chris. I learned a ton about the uranium sector in general from you, so that's great. Do you have any final words on Pegasus Resources you'd like to share before I let you go? Anything you think investors should be paying attention to?
Just give us a follow on X, Pegasus Resources Inc. And we're here. We're looking for uranium, and we expect to have a great 2024 and 2025.
Excellent. Well, I'll put a link to your profile on X as well as the company website in the description below for anybody who wants to check that out. Thank you once again, Chris, for coming on and sharing your knowledge with the audience.
I had a great time, Jesse. Thank you.
Commodity Culture is a podcast that covers investing in commodities and natural resources. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe so you are always alerted of the latest episodes.